Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington policymakers, DC insiders, and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. Good evening, everyone. And welcome to the Hack in 1229. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, and we're excited to have you here with us for this special edition of the Washington AI Network podcast. And everyone here is a subscriber. We love you for that. We love you for the work you do in Washington. We're going to meet many of you shortly. In this episode, we partnered with the General Catalyst Institute. Let's hear it for them. Yes. Almost a year old. You'll hear from some of GC's founders leading the way in defense tech, robotics, advanced manufacturing. But first, we're honored to welcome two special guests. Our first guest is Teresa Carlson, the founding president of the General Catalyst Institute. Teresa is a longtime force in Washington, leading at the intersection of technology and government. Among her many, many achievements, Teresa built Amazon Web Services public sector business. Okay, write this down. From a two-person operation to over 17,000, from zero revenue to multi-billions. Congratulations on all of that. She's helping government transformation to the cloud. General Catalyst Institute is a policy shop, and there's nothing more important than policy right now in Washington, D.C., as we continue to watch AI change this incredible world. Welcome, Teresa.
Thank you.
Okay. And joining Teresa is Dr. Jason Rathje. As I just explained, he just left the Pentagon 3 weeks ago. Let's hear from him. He was director and co-founder of the Office of Strategic Capital at the Department of Defense, no easy thing. As many of you know, OSC's mission is to attract and scale private capital in support of national security, including the development and implementation of new financial tools to increase public-private investments in our nation's defense. Jason, thank you. We're so glad you could be here. You served as the director and co-founder of AF Ventures, the Department of the Air Force's commercial investment arm. Thank you for doing that. Welcome, welcome, Wes and Jason. Now, Teresa, let's start with you. It's been like 7 months, and it's been a big week here in Washington. We've got the reconciliation bill. We've got all kinds of things going on. And tell us what policies you guys are focused on right now.
Well, first of all, it has been a really interesting week with the big, beautiful bill. But before I even jump into that, Tammy, I'll just say what we've really been focused on this week. We've had six of our founders, CEOs, and tech leaders with us. We talked a lot about instead of the hill going to the valley coming to the hill. And it's important for, I think, our founders, our companies to understand how Washington, D.C. works. There's never been a time that I've ever seen in my career where you have more amazing technology startups that are so focused on the mission of the U.S. federal government, in particular the national security and defense space, at a level that's unprecedented. And artificial intelligence, AI, is driving a lot of that. AI is not new, but it's evolved to a level that we see these companies with so much energy and just knowledge around what they're doing. And also you see here in Washington, D.C., on the policy front, there's a big focus on the new defense industrial base, and that's really what we're investing in. Now, the current defense industrial base is really important to, of course, our mission and what we do, but they need more support, and we heard a lot about that this week. So for us at the General Catalyst Institute, our entire purpose in life is about both promoting positive policies that allow our companies, over 800 globally, to grow and thrive, be very collaborative with the U.S. government so that we could not just bring problems to the table. We want to bring solutions to them so that we can show them options for how they get things done, but also be transparent and really bring to the table on what are these blockers that are really causing the startups not to be able to take advantage of the work that really needs to get done. The bottom line of all this is America is great, and we've got to keep America great. And unless we move a lot faster on the technological front, we could fall behind. And now we have three wars that we've been fighting across the globe. No one would have ever dreamed that we would be using drones for fighting battles. The whole landscape has changed globally. For us, it's about our founders, making sure that we're listening to them, that we're really supporting them on the right policies.
Well, the barriers, you apparently, Jason, knocked them all down over there at the Air Force.
Not all.
And as I said, you left 3 weeks ago. So what's left to do? Because you have opened up these relationships. And really what we want to know is it partnership? Is it just funding for these companies? Is it another way to fund the government? People don't really understand how it works.
First of all, I just want to say it's great that General Catalyst is here. I mean, I've been in this space now for 8 years, from the Air Force, building AFWERX to OSC. Now I remember some of the first early panels that we had were with General Catalyst. And I've seen them in events across my career, both in the U.S. and overseas. And there's just been so many great companies that have been invested in by the fund that I've had the opportunity to work with. It's really a combination of funding. It's a combination of regulation. It's continuously working on acquisition reform. But at the end of the day, what companies are now able to do is deliver products at scale to warfighters. And that has been an evolution that has taken decades for us to get to. I mean, I don't think people really realize the amount of thought that got put into even the first instantiation of DIU. You know, that was an Ash Carter concept, and he wrote about that back
That's
in the early.
That's the Defense Innovation Unit, for those who don't.
And the Defense Innovation Unit has really been at the front edge of a lot of the great work bringing new tech companies into the department. But that concept started back in the early 90s, right at the end of the Cold War. And we've recognized from a policy and an economic lens, which is where my academic background is that we need to find new ways to get great companies with great talent supporting the department while we're at an era of declining defense spending as a share of GDP. And even if you could triple, quadruple spending, but the commercial market's going to outpace defense spending and really should, right? Nobody wants to see just trillions and trillions of dollars of defense spending. So how do we get around that? Well, it's by working with new companies doing incredible things on the innovation side. They're going to be able to deliver products at scale at far cheaper costs than what we're currently buying today. And by the way, that increases competition, right? Which puts pressure on companies to continuously deliver. When you see a consolidation like we have over the last, 25 years, you really eliminate ideas, the technologies, the opportunities that are going to flow towards the people who need them the most.
So is that the war fighters jumping in like, hey, you better give us some better stuff? You know, why are there better, drones in Ukraine than what we have? I mean, how does that work when you talk about the war fighter?
At the end of the day, the war fighter is going to get translated into the budgets through requirements, right? So the war fighter generally through the Joint Staff and the Pentagon is going to own the requirements pipeline. And then we're going to see what requirements are the most important requirements. And that's where the budget priorities go. So the president's budget was just released, I think, a couple of weeks ago. And you can take a look at that right away and you can know what are the requirements for the Department of Defense. It's in black and white. But what I think you're seeing now is the opportunity for defense spending to meet the opportunities that are available for warfighters, right? There's a famous Henry Ford quote. If you ask a person, they want a faster horse, right? Nobody's going to say they want a car before they see a car in action. Now they see cars in action. Well, now what does everybody want? I mean, there's $1.5 billion in the reconciliation bill for small UAS industrial base, $1.5 billion. I was working on drones 15 years ago. It wasn't $1.5 billion for drones, right? So I think we see both the capabilities being deployed in the field. We see how it quickly gets translated into the budget. And now the next step is how well does that money flow to the companies that can deliver that product?
Well, that's my question. So the money's in the reconciliation bill. How does it get to, say, some of the people in the room, primes? How does that work?
At the end of the day, the money's going to get spent through solicitations for proposals for different technologies that are going to go towards the opportunities and the requirements that the government has proposed. But I think the really incredible thing that we're seeing now is, I mean, this is why we spent OSC's time focusing on, is it's not just defense companies solely to the DOD. I mean, you talk about the new defense industrial base. It's just a new industrial base, right? OSC's mission was to invest in the industrial commercial base that supports U.S. national security. It wasn't just drones, it was semiconductors. It wasn't just AI, it was casting and forging presses. I mean, there's a whole range of companies now that are coming up, and many of them are coming up on the tech venture side. The opportunity for the government now to do direct investment at all levels of the supply chain. I mean, what has everybody been talking about in the DoD's critical minerals? You're going to get anybody to talk about that 3 years ago. Yeah. Right? Now we all recognize that, well, magnets are going away. So we got to figure that out now, because it doesn't matter how many great companies we have doing what they want in drones. We can't get magnets. We're not doing much.
Right. Right? You got to have critical minerals. And I'll just say real quickly on that is, additionally, I like the idea of these requirements, and I totally know that the requirements roll up. However, I think the differentiator is these companies are innovating on behalf of government. So they're not always just waiting for a requirement. Now, in my day of building the cloud, if we would have waited for the government to ask us for cloud, they were kind of talking around the edges of all this stuff. So I think you can look for signals, too, that we hear from DoD and government. You hear the signals, and you can actually build a lot of solutions to innovate on behalf. A lot of our companies have seen this from the inside out and the outside in. And when you start looking at, I'll call it the belly of the beast, you know what they really need. And sometimes they struggle with actually always getting the requirements because they're doing it in a very traditional way. And really what we're trying to do is transform that, shake it up, get DoD to think a little bit differently. And we're seeing that. And I will say our company's really happy because there are some of these other more agile contracting methods like the CBRS. Most of our companies have those. We're seeing a lot more OTAs being let out for the companies. And I'll just share, we spent half a day at the Pentagon 2 days ago, and they could not have been more open with the companies. They were very, very business friendly. They were very happy to hear from them and basically said, look, our job is to be more commercial, open up the window of opportunity, make sure that you get the right introductions and that you understand how to move forward in the contracting process. They made it very clear it was not easy. And I've told all these companies, you already know it, this doing business with the U.S. federal government and DoD is an enterprise of enterprises, and it's not for the faint of heart. So you have to have a mission heart about doing it, and you have to understand how the budgets work. You need to figure out how to get in front of it. And I would say we'll hear from some of them in a little bit, but probably a little bit of some of the frustration is that sometimes they see an end-to-end view of how to solve a problem. And within the budgeting process, it only allows for step processes sometimes. It may seem complicated to the world we're living in a defense budgeting cycle and requirements, but actually, it's a very simple solving technology world, but we can solve that for you. So this was, I think, getting them to shake up their thinking on how we solve some of these really complex problems that shouldn't take us 25 steps over 6 years. Let's do the plan. Let us show you how we can solve that very quickly. And I really do believe this is what DoD is trying to accomplish. And we heard that also directly from the Hill in the White House. So it's very inspiring, quite frankly.
But right now, you've got some of the biggest tech companies, Meta, OpenAI, et cetera, in addition to Amazon, Microsoft, who's always really worked with DoD, Google, and they're all saying, hey, we want a piece of the action. This is for both of you. Jason, I'll start with you. How do the startups, how do the smaller companies, how can they be on the, you know, the same step at the same time to, you know, make those deals?
In my time with the Air Force, it brought in over 1,800 new companies into working with the department. Companies that I never thought of.
Okay, wait a minute. Come on now. He's the one.
I mean, my heart is always with small business and tech innovation. And I think that small businesses have the ability over larger businesses and agility. And if they make the decision to spend time and focus on the department, they're going to be able to understand and service those needs in a far greater capacity and far more adept to what those are than the bigs are. And I think that's just kind of always been true. I think the hard part is not about getting in, right? I think that problem's mostly solved, in my opinion. The hard part is getting to scale.
Yes.
And great. I think that when you look at where we are in the budgeting process, I mean, if you just look at the reconciliation tax and you look at the president's budget, and you see the requirements that are in now for now companies that started on this journey 6 years ago, there are programs being built for those technologies that have been invested through private capital, through alternative sources of investment dollars. It's not just government spending a bunch of R&D money on this anymore. Right. Now you have private companies funding hypersonics. I mean, it's incredible. So now we have programs being started that are purpose built to build requirements around what exists. Now, how do we build an actual scalable program to do that? And it's only because these companies are in there day one working on it, as opposed to the bigs who have an incredible enterprise technology that can come in and service needs right off the bat. But they're going to be competing over the things that exist today. They're not going to be forward leaning into what's coming.
Well, and just what Jason said is so true, because also to get to scale, he said it, all of this stuff is about scale. And we talked a lot as an example about drones and manufacturing. And if we can't get that to scale, we've lost a lot of our muscle here in the U.S. on manufacturing capability. We don't have the minerals. We've heard that a lot from both DOD and the White House and Congress on the fact that, look, minerals is going to be a big part of what we need to do and get right in this country. The other thing that I really found super interesting is that when we think about supply chains too in this country, this administration is not only thinking about what we offer here in the U.S., but they're thinking about what good partners offer with that, with their ability to build that supply chain out. So, you know, considering, can we do all of this just in America? The answer is probably no. We know we need good allies and partners to do this. So who are those secure supply chain partners that we can use and not just rely on ourselves? Because that would take us a long time, because we've lost the muscle. We've got to really figure out how to build that muscle back up.
Well, that's part of the other thing, the security issue, Jason. You've got so many of these small companies. Doesn't it take forever to get security clearances? Has any of that been updated in a way that helps you?
We're talking about ATOs backstage. Yeah. And then, I mean, even just understanding your financial accounting systems, there's a whole level of regulatory overhead that comes with going into the defense market. And frankly, I think a lot of companies, when they come in with maybe a bit of a misconception, because they come in through some of these vehicles like SBIR, where those are reduced as entry
ways
in. Small Business Innovative Research Grants, it's a $5-ish billion program across every government department. DOD is the bulk of that money. But it's kind of an easier entryway for small businesses to come into the department. But it reduces some of those regulatory barriers. Like, you don't have to have the same financial accounting systems in place like you do if you're a big defense contractor.
Is all of this in Perplexity? I just want to know. I feel like there should be an AI just like for the DOD. Anyone in the room working on that?
I think there's a huge opportunity in this space. I mean, some of these regulations are going away. The ATO problem is incredibly hard. It's been there for 15 years, right? I used to work on a program, the DCGS, the Defense Common Ground System program, which is the kind of Palantir entryway into scaled growth. Every military service has their own
reciprocity
system.
Well, why don't you guys pull it all together and get everyone to work together?
Can I say something about this,
Jamie? Yeah, please.
I'm just much more of a glass half full, and I'll tell you why. I want to go back and remind everybody, there was no such thing as FedRAMP. Now, I know it's still not perfect, but when we started cloud, there was FISMA, and FISMA was a very old and outdated model for cybersecurity requirements. As soon as you printed that piece of paper, it was outdated. When I started the AWS business, we worked very proactively with DOD and GSA on we need a new model. And it took them a while, but they created something called FedRAMP. Now, to Jason's point, the issue is it's not scaled yet. It's back to scale. And so you can get the government to actually move pretty quickly. So I'm very optimistic. I think it's on us a bit in the industry now to demonstrate to government that you can build a technology solution that allows you to automate all of this. This is not a hard problem to solve. We're pretending like it's a hard problem. It's a cultural problem more. And we talked about, you got to be able to change the culture part.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I may have your attention. This is Mark Huntington, PhysicsX Managing Director. Let's hear it for him.
Thank you. And to talk a little bit about the problem we were discussing, this was in the certification process. We're specifically talking to B2 Bomberet, who is looking for ways to certify new munitions, new payloads. And it took 2 years to go from they have a new system to deploy, to getting certification through a Seek Eagle process. If you think about changing that and moving to much more of a model-based certification process, not only can that speed up that
part of the process, but you can also give those tools to the primes and other innovators who are developing this, so they know even before they go to the certification process whether or not they're going to pass. And that reduces the number of iterations you have. It reduces the regulatory burden and the administrative burden on the people who are doing the certification, because you're not going over and over and over again. And everyone's reading from the same kind of transparent view of the actual performance of the system. It increases safety. It increases reliability of the solution while also massively speeding up the whole system.
What's your take, Jason?
Yeah, it's spot on. I mean, we were talking about this 6 years ago. Will Roper used to be my boss. He was the head of acquisitions for the Air Force. He wrote this piece about digital twins. And talked exactly about this. He talked about the Century Series aircraft, where he's turning a new gen aircraft every 6 months in the 1950s, and how we thought about certification and safety. And how do we do that today? I got the kind of goal for the Air Force at the time is to do a fully digitally certified aircraft before he took its first flight, right? Which blew the Air Force's mind. And I think that the point that you're making, though, that I think is really salient to me is it really takes organizations like yours to bring a voice to the department to say, not only is this a good idea, we can do this, here's how we can do this. And it has to be continuous.
Yes.
Everything I've done inside the government, I've done two government startups, it is endurance. It's endurance that wins the game, and you have to be there day in, day out. I've seen the most talented people I've ever worked with inside the government.
Yeah.
And I think that they're dedicated to the mission. They want to change things, but they need ideas and champions and a partner on the outside to make it happen. And it's companies like yours that can actually break through the noise and drive the policy.
And one other point I want to make, just because it's such an important issue and it is a real policy blocker, is that the other huge benefit to doing this, and we actually did this when I was at AWS, we started building with compliance in mind. So you build from the very beginning to that coding with governance and compliance in mind when you understand those requirements. Now, the even newer way, the better way, is if you're doing this with technology, it allows those engineers to constantly in real time be able to update and change their code. So it's speeding up the process at a massive scale. If we could change this one thing right now, it would be a massive improvement for the U.S. federal government to move faster. Just use the tools and the automation.
Thank you so much, Mark. Let's hear from Mark. Okay, I have one more question for the two of you. Jason, let's go straight to artificial intelligence. I'm not going to ask you what you worry about. I'm not going to ask you what you love. But what I'd like you to do is talk about what you've seen and what you see coming that people should really focus on and you think are going to change things. And we've got these two wars, as Teresa mentioned. This is all taking place in front of us. It's changed everything. But what have you seen?
The thing that I'm most excited about on the AI front as it relates to national security is the future of war. I think we've seen it firsthand now, is multi-domain, right? It's not just air, land, sea, space, cyber, EW, economic. I mean, there's so many different domains to the future of conflict. And you need a level of artificial intelligence to process those signals to drive real decision-making information at multiple levels of planning, not the tactical, operational, and strategic. And even in the last 6 months, I've seen some companies developing incredible non-cloud native, permissible, fully networked, fully secure AI that is able to process information in a highly disrupted environment. I mean, I was working on technologies 15 years ago, trying to do shared compute. After the Boston Marathon bombings happened, we worked with the Massachusetts government to create a system to share compute in case there was a network disruption because everybody was trying to call home. It happened last week in the floods. I mean, people can't communicate because there's saturation. That is an area of future conflict, and this is one that the military has been paying close attention to. There's technologies now that can overcome that, that can share compute and do model generation at the edge. It's blowing my mind. And now, you know, I've been out for 3 weeks and I finally got a chance to dig into some of these companies. And it really is incredible stuff. And I think that we're just getting started on the AI side.
What about on the power side? We need more power. How's the military going to deal with that?
I think the military needs to look at solutions that have low power requirement solutions, right? Like non-cloud cloud native AI, which is what I get excited about. The military is not going to solve the domestic power problem for cloud AI. That's going to be the domain of the Department of Interior, Department of Energy, maybe the Department of Treasury, right? I think that there's a lot of...
The treasurer is here today. Is he still here? Oh, we'll ask him later.
we'll put it on his list. Credits, I'm sure companies would love, right?
Right.
Invest in energy. I think that problem has to be solved. And I think the government recognizes that problem has to be solved. I mean, I've heard a lot about it when I was in. From a national security perspective, you have the power you have, right? You know, you're not going to be forward deployed and be able to build a giant power plant, right? Maybe you get some of these small modular reactors out there, but there's a lot of things that the military is concerned about as it relates to power. The AI is going to have to service on functions. I mean, we have the B-52 bombers around since the 1960s, right? At the end of the day, the military is going to have to find ways to deploy AI in a way that doesn't draw an immense power.
And two quick things, Tammy. One is on the power side, you know, when you think about building AI, there's multiple parts that you need to be successful. And it's not any one thing. And if you go talk to all the big tech companies building it, they'll say, is it power today? Is it chips today? It's all these things. Is it land? Is it access? There's so much. And I would say these problems, again, I'll go back to private capital. Private capital will be a way to really help solve a lot of these problems and think creatively about solving it. We can't rely on government to do all this work. We're going to have to come together with both the public and the private sector, put private capital to work. I'd love Kerry to talk for a second because we have a company called Rebuild Manufacturing. Rebuild is a company that has been thinking for a long time about rebuilding American manufacturing, which, you know, nobody was really talking about this much a few years ago. It was kind of noise, but now it's come to the forefront that we have to rebuild American manufacturing. And they're a company that's thinking deeply and investing. We're one of the investors. We think that this is key. We need a lot more people. We shouldn't be the only people investing in this. We need a lot of people investing here. But Kerry, you want to talk about kind of what you're doing and some of your thoughts just around what you've heard this week?
So this is Kerry Browning, everyone. We need to welcome her. She's Chief Commercial Officer for Rebuild.
Hello.
Thanks, Kerry.
Thank you. Rebuild was founded in 2020, and it was based on a long-time conversation between our co-founders that they needed to revitalize the U.S. manufacturing base. And so I think what we hear a lot today is maybe an underestimation of what that really takes to get done. Some of the companies that they've acquired are very deep in their spaces, right? Composite capabilities that are 20 years old, metal capabilities that are 35 years old. And so when you start to take some of these very expert builders and capabilities and combine those with newer technologies, layers of technology that help us move faster, think software, robotics, automation, structural engineering, aerospace engineering, and then we can start to take those capabilities and help them work together more effectively, we can start to move very, very fast. I'll give you an example. We did this kind of internal project for ourselves because we get approached a lot on the drone side, and the team wanted to build something that they could use as a technology demonstrator, and instead of answering the call of a customer, they said, we want to do something so that we can show everyone what we can do, but we can also test our own processes and build some tool strings for ourselves because no one's asking us for this. And so they basically built a tool string that allowed them to simulate a flying wing version of a drone, which is a harder version to build. They simulated it very accurately. You know, we talk a lot about simulation. It was actually spot on. And that allows the center of gravity to be perfect. It allows the weight to be perfect. They were 99.995% accurate with the weight. And so everything landed the first time. And so when you're not having to iterate and you can do something like that, we can move very, very quickly by taking traditional and novel methods. And so they were able to go from idea on a sheet of paper to a flying object in under 4 months with four people using distributed engineering capabilities and the components and everything and the capabilities that we had in-house. I think it's just a very powerful example of how you start to bring those things together to behave differently.
Well, and also you're talking about, what is it, 13 different companies? So you're pulling companies together so that you have the expert in each of the issues.
Yes, and so they're able to stand on their own. So those companies kind of remain as a growing concern, but then they also work together in a collaborative model with the other companies in the network.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. And let's thank Jason and Teresa.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you. Now we'll hear from three General Catalyst Institute startup founders and CEOs on how they're building the future of national security. They've been in D.C. all week. We call them fly-ins here in town. And they're important so that the government can hear what private industry is doing and what they need to grow their business and the economy. Let's hear it. Yeah. Okay.
please join me in welcoming John Battles, co-founder and head of tech strategy for Cobot. John, welcome, welcome. Cameron McCord, the CEO of Nominal, a company that is creating a modern software suite that is purpose-built for complex hardware workflows. This is Cameron's second appearance on the podcast. How about that? You're the first person that we've had back. I'm going to tell some of these other CEOs that they have to stand behind you. Okay. And then rounding us out is Evan Beard, founder and CEO of Standard Bots, which builds American-made robotic arms powered by AI. New task is super cool. I can't believe the arms. You actually have someone show the robot how to do it, and the robot does it. John, I want to start with you. You're an Amazon veteran. You have been the head of technology at Ronald Inks. Tell us about the company and where you are today.
Collaborative Robotics, as you said, ex-Amazon tech executives. Our experience was engineering and building much of Amazon's infrastructure. We knew that level of technology need to be brought into both public and the private sector. And we're super fortunate to have our first CBR with DoD. We've manufactured our first version of a mobile autonomous robot. That robot is meant to service many different industries and functions. We're in logistics, healthcare, like I said, our first CBR, and working in manufacturing. Our goal is to really try and help the Department of Defense with logistics, doing really what we call the dirty, dangerous jobs. We would really like to see robotics doing that. We're super excited. I also want to say this week, it was such an eye-opener. It was so refreshing, and I want to say a big thank you to everybody here. I wish all Americans could come in and see how dedicated all of you are, the Department of Defense, in protecting this country and all of us. Right. I'm walking away really
amazing
impressed.
Amazing people.
Yeah.
We have many people from government here, as well as policymakers and people working on it. John, that's great. Cameron, talk about Nominal.
Good to be here. Cameron, co-founder and CEO of Nominal. So we build a software platform for hardware testing, validation, certification. And to really give us a perspective, around 75% of our business is directly with the commercial industry. And put simply, it is a solved problem in the world today to test and validate, monitor, and deploy software. There have been billion-dollar businesses that have been built over the last two decades to solve that problem. It's very easy to do. That same luxury does not exist if you are building hardware, and specifically software-defined hardware. And so that's really the problem and the opportunity that we're tackling. And we think that as all of these systems are more robotic, more software-defined, more autonomous, there's a huge need. For commercial companies, the value that we offer is accelerating their ability to test and validate and certify and ship their end products. It's a huge competitive advantage. The companies we work with, you know, their executives look across their products and programs, and they equate the amount of data generated during testing, the amount of testing, and the time between tests as a direct correlation with how successful that product's going to be. We're really excited to serve and work with the department. And I always like to think about the work that Nominal does there in government parlance or government speak in terms of cost, performance, schedule. And so from a cost perspective, our software is enabling the government to make informed, independent, validated decisions around testing to the tune of sometimes saving hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars by not flying an additional sortie or realizing that the solid rocket motor test campaign that they've run, like they've actually hit the requirements they need to by being able to stitch together a bunch of different tests. On the performance side, we're very proud to work with a lot of the leading drone manufacturers, and you know, we see drones that have been shipped over to Ukraine is a very common example, really the flip of a coin on whether or not those are going to work. Around a 50% success rate for those systems working downrange.
And why is that?
A lot of it is so such a dynamic, particularly electronic warfare EW environment there, that it's very difficult to predict whether or not the communications and the flight software and avionics on these systems are going to perform. And so the ability to test both downrange and have a linkage between test results that are happening in a representative environment, and then be able to do that again stateside is what a lot of our customers are doing. And then the last one I'll say on schedule is just moving faster. And that's very thematic with a lot of what we hear Admiral Davidson talking about 2027 and potential conflict with the Chinese Communist Party. Time matters. And so just being able to test and move faster and faster. So,
okay, I want to come back to that. Evan, Standard Bots, tell them more about your incredible robots.
founder and CEO of Standard Bots. Mm-hmm. And I'll just add, Nominal is phenomenal software. We're signing up.
We got a sign up tonight. Okay, our first deal.
So if you're a manufacturer today and you buy a robot arm, 99% of them are not made in this country. And what we're setting out to do is make an American-made arm that's easier to use, because the products today are arcane. It's like 80s mainframe software. So making a robot arm that's super simple to use, like an iPhone-like experience. And the other problem is robot arms are so limited in what they can automate today. So we've made an experience where you can demonstrate a task to a robot arm, physically do it with your hands, either through VR or through a handheld device. And that trains an AI model where the robot can autonomously perform the task. And this is one of the core problems our country faces to bring back manufacturing, which is important for national defense. It's important for lowering the cost of food, important for the environment, for all these things. We need to be able to automate. We need to be able to bring back manufacturing. So we need to be able to automate more tasks and do it in an easy way with an easy product. So that's what we're doing at Standard Bots. We're growing extremely quickly, almost doubling every quarter of revenue. We work all the way from Fortune 500s down to small moms and pops.
You know, on the internet, especially on Instagram, I don't go on TikTok, all you see are armies of Chinese robots, right? And what a percentage of robots are made in China?
It's a good question. Used in the US, it's almost zero. So we are not today using very many Chinese-made arms. We are using mostly arms from Japan. Fanuc is the leader. And there's Denmark, Universal Robots. It's mostly Europe and Japan.
Right? So this week, you were at the White House, you were at the Pentagon, on Capitol Hill. What did they say about what you're doing? I mean, do you think there's an understanding that this is the opportunity now?
I would say General Catalyst Institute put on the most amazing week of meetings. Teresa and team were incredible. If you're thinking about raising money, it's a reason to take General Catalyst money right off the bat.
How about that endorsement?
We met with our Penn nominee for the CTO of the United States. We met with CTOs of the Army and Air Force here. We met with people in the liaison's office, other folks at the White House, folks working on the National Robotics Strategy.
You know, the issue is you've got a lot of people going to these offices, right? There's only so much money in the government for these kinds of projects. Again, we talked earlier about the hyperscalers, and then you come in and you've got a lot of experience and you've got product. But do you feel like they really got what you were doing and that they were going to advocate, not just for startups, but specifically for what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a bipartisan issue to bring back manufacturing. I think everyone recognizes that it's key to national security to have a strong manufacturing base in the United States. I think that we are early in figuring out how to do that. So what we heard this week is that this is a priority and that the government, I think across the board, is open to suggestion. It really feels like a moment of tremendous change. I was inspired to see the passion of everyone in government to improve the status quo, to make changes, to improve the country. I think people recognize it's a priority.
And Cameron, you've been in Washington for a while. You've been at a lot of these meetings. What did you hear this week? Because there is a larger sense that now is the time to get something done and really protect the U.S.
No, absolutely. I think I heard some themes that all echo from earlier conversations, but I think one is an administration that is very in sync, I think, and aligned on the priorities. The uniformity of things like supply chain, critical minerals was mentioned many times. I think bringing back manufacturing, it's very impressive to sort of hear those topics over and over again. I think on a flip side to that, that's kind of the optimistic framing. I think the flip side is we met with a lot of performing the duties of, yet to be fully confirmed, a lot of people that are sort of knowingly under-resourced from a personnel perspective, understaffed. And so I think there's simultaneously this incredible alignment, this incredible understanding of the problem and the challenges at hand. There is a ton of capital that is about to enter the system. There are leaders from commercial industry that are coming into this administration and understand the power of technology. But similarly, it's going to be about where the rubber meets the road and actually sort of getting after these things in a very real way.
John, can you talk about supply chain, not just with your work at Amazon and now at Cobot, but it really is about the supply chain. Everyone wants things to be better, but if you can't get the critical minerals, if you can't get these things, is anything really changing on that? And what's your recommendation?
Supply chain is critical. I think we all know supply chain is critical. And unfortunately, we've taken supply chain as I'll just order the part I need. And we haven't looked at everything behind the supply chain. You brought up critical rare earth minerals, critical minerals, the refining plants, the tooling plants. So supply chain is a big thing. And in order to retool in order to actually get supply chains going in the U.S., it's a big initiative. It's not going to happen overnight, for certain. The supply chains are critical. COVID taught us how critical the supply chains were. I was head of COVID innovation, and we had to fly in masks from China for our employees. We just simply couldn't make them in the U.S. Massive eye-opener. So we really need to understand everything we're going to need for this next generation of Department of Defense systems, supporting the manufacturers, the private sector. That's a massive task and program.
So it sounds like we need a supply chain czar or something in the U.S. Anyone here want to volunteer for that? No, no volunteers. Someone should be volunteering. All these guys are doing great government service. But my question is, and you guys, again, had these meetings, do you think there's a fundamental understanding and a change? I mean, maybe AI is the accelerant that this has to be fixed now, because it's nice we're talking about it. Yeah. But if the changes don't happen, I don't know how you can scale these products that you're talking about. Evan?
Yeah, we actually polled a couple hundred manufacturers before coming to DC because we wanted to hear what do they need to grow their manufacturing businesses, to automate, to be able to scale up. And we heard a number of things that we brought to our meetings. One is that we need better training. We need to train the workers who are going to be the machinists. We're going to be the casters, the welders. We don't have enough. And the training that we do have, it doesn't align with the actual commercial products that manufacturers buy and use. So that's one big piece. We've heard the need for centers of excellence. Any hardware company in the United States can tell you, if you quote parts in the U.S. versus China, it's 10x more to make parts in the U.S. So even if you want to, you're paying 10 times the cost. And part of the reason for that is we don't have these centers of excellence that show you how do you make a machine shop that is absolutely best in class. And there's processes, it's equipment, it's all that kind of stuff. We don't have that for casting. We don't have it for powder coating, for welding, for polishing. And that's what we really need. And so that's part of it. We need these centers of excellence. I think it's narrative. We see stats from the A3, one of the leading industry organizations. When we automate, it actually creates jobs. And that's what they've seen across manufacturers across the country. So the narrative needs to be that this is important to create jobs, and that's what the stats are showing. So those are some of the things that we've seen, and supply chain is a big part of that. And I think as we solve these problems, that you can get parts made here and it's competitive to do so, the supply chain will start to take care of itself.
So Cameron, the private capital is coming in. We've talked about it a lot tonight. That's all good. But do you see these kinds of, you know, what did you call it? Centers of excellence? Is that like code language?
I just made that up.
Okay. I was going to say, that wasn't in my notes. I kind of like it, though.
Centers of excellence absolutely do exist all throughout the government and the United States military. Those are great things for companies like General Catalyst Investing to tap into. They exist. They need to be scaled. And so we need to find the champions, and centers of excellence do that. And so when you find that center of excellence, or if it's that person, that is the way to go.
And what is the path to making them bigger or more well-funded?
So centers of excellence don't depend on funding. It's more on the statutory side and their remit on what they're tasked with doing. The funding we have found through reconciliation. So you're going to find centers of excellence tapping into these companies here in front of you tonight. They're going to be able to do those things that the centers of excellence already know exist. And now they're going to have that money to unlock the great capabilities of standard bots, of nominal, and of cobots, and of all the companies in the defense industrial base and the new defense industrial base that are really going to be great.
Wow, I like that. Okay, you got to talk with Jonathan Clifford. John, what would you like to see? You're talking to government right now. They're all listening very carefully.
Yep.
What do you think can happen now? Because the experience that you've had is very unusual here, because in many ways, in those early days at Amazon, you know, not just creating the cloud, but the first private hands on government.
I want to echo something that was said earlier, is that the government has some of the most intelligent people ever worked with. I saw that all week long. The people know what needs to be done. They know what the barriers are. They know the blockers. They know the technologies that need to be developed. The money's coming in. We hope the money's coming in. So now it's about how do we get results? And I think that's the partnership with private sector, small business. It's now aligning these needs to a quick execution plan. And then how do we get more involved to help solve that? But it's unlocking it. I still think that there's this sense of a barrier because of process and everything that everybody has to go through. Just the systems are all perceived as barriers. I think that's the first thing. The government has to unlock those barriers and move quickly. In business, we move quick. When something happens, those guidelines are guidelines. And we'll take the ones that are critical, but we're going to move very quick. And I think that's what has to happen.
I spoke with someone from the Army the week of their 250th anniversary. And when you were recruited or applied to be in the Army, you had to fill out 700 pieces of paper. And what they changed it to, does anyone know? Under 10. So this is all taking place right now. Please join me in thanking our great guests. And General Catalyst Institute, we're proud to partner with you. The work you're doing is remarkable. It's exciting to be up close and watch all this happen. And I know with these kind of founders that so many things will happen. That'll help all of us. So thank you again. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.